Welcome to Office Hours with Adam Peterson, where I talk to business owners, employees, entrepreneurs and experts to find answers to those day-to-day questions about life and work in Luxembourg. If you have questions you'd like answered, let me know at adam.peterson@rtl.lu or on LinkedIn. But for now, on to today's show. A pilot from Klushino climbed into Vostok 1 and completed the first ever successful manned space flight. And to mark the 65th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's flight, we will launch into Luxembourg space business on today's episode of Office Hours. Who are the people that work in the space industry? Why is Luxembourg a space hub? And will vacations on the moon be available in my lifetime? To help me answer these questions and more, I'm joined by Jordan Vanitsen, CEO of Odysseus Space.
Thank you.
Sabrina Alam, CEO of Matter Space and Defence and Space Lead of S&T Tech Transfer Office at uni.lu.
Thank you. Looking forward to be here.
And Javier Stober, Lead Mechanical Engineer at Lunar Outpost EU.
Thank you, Adam.
It's worth mentioning that I invited Javier on as an engineer, so you're not a spokesperson for the company, so any opinions are your own, whereas for the CEOs, you don't get that getting to jail.
Fair enough.
But let's get a bit into your backstory. So Jordan, how did you get into the space industry?
Since I was a child, I always wanted to explore things and go far away, and I thought space would be the big frontier, right?
So you're into like Star Trek and all of those sorts of things?
I was a big like sci-fi fan, yes. But you know what made me go to really like study space was I went to this Cassini-Huygens event. So it was a probe designed for decades, and it was designed in Europe, and it was made to land on Titan.
So Titan's a moon of Jupiter?
It's a moon of Saturn. And I went to that event to follow live, you know, the landing on Titan. It was the first time we landed so far. And it's still, as of today, the human-made object the furthest away in the solar system.
How long ago was that?
I was 18 years old, so that was 21 years ago. I see all these people working for decades and discovering a new world, and I found it amazing. And this is, you know, this was a sparkle for me.
And then your company, though, so tell me about how Odysseus Space came around.
So I study space engineering. I also did a PhD in astrophysics in Taiwan. And when I was in Taiwan, I saw more and more opportunities with semiconductor industry and more space activities. And actually, with some friends, we started a company there. The company was doing space consultancy. We were helping customers with their space mission. And we had a customer who had a mission to detect exoplanets.
So exoplanets are planets outside of our solar system, is that right?
Yes, but which could possibly have a life similar as what we know. And they had a device in this satellite that we were supporting the mission. They had a device to be very precise. And, you know, we were thinking, what's the next big challenge in space? It's to transfer data. A lot of data. And a way to do that is laser communication. It's very directional, so you need to be very precise. Basically, laser communication, actually, you are using it every day in optical fiber at home. It's a light which goes in the fiber, right? So actually, what we do right now, it's exactly the same thing. Laser communication in space.
Javier, were you a Trekkie?
I have to admit that I've never watched an episode of Star Trek. I'm sorry.
Star Wars?
Every single one. Yeah.
It's always one or the other, isn't it?
Yeah. I grew up in Florida in the United States where rockets were launching. And if you're a young, impressionable pre-teenager watching rockets launch, it's pretty easy to get motivated. And
so you could see them taking off from Cape Canaveral from where you lived?
From my home about 200 kilometers away.
Oh, wow.
You can see them from that far away. If you go to Cape Canaveral, which I strongly recommend anybody do, you can feel them very much. If you haven't seen a rocket launch, it's something that would change your life. Yeah.
And what year did you grow up?
Well, my first rocket launch was on February 7th, 2001. It was STS-98 Atlantis. And that one was a huge deal for me. So 25 years ago, I celebrated of being motivated to be in the space environment. Yeah.
Fantastic. And then how did you get from being a kid in Florida watching rockets to Lunar Outpost EU in Luxembourg?
Well, I took a track then of starting to build rockets in the backyard, read astronomy textbooks, studied at school. I knew exactly what I wanted to do when I got to school. Went to Stanford for a PhD in chemical rocket propulsion, went to MIT to work for 4 years and started working on lunar experimentation. I led a lunar experiment that went to the moon in 2023. And because of that experiment, I connected with my company, Lunar Outpost, who is also and is now actually the leader in lunar infrastructure.
You led an experiment?
Yes, sir.
So tell me what that experiment was.
It was called the Passive Regolith Sampler. So it was a little business card, essentially sized aluminum case that tried to passively gather regolith. It was on a regolith is loose dirt on the lunar surface. And it was on the wheel of a lunar rover that would drive over the lunar surface and then gather that dirt.
So your mission was to collect space dust, effectively, and bring it back home?
Oh, well, this was just technology demonstration to, in that case, just use it there. In the ideal case, yeah, we'd develop that technology further and either use it on the lunar surface or it is something that could be used for planetary resources to be brought back home.
Yeah, and Sabrina, I bet you couldn't see any rockets from Cape Canaveral growing up in West London then. So how did you get into the space industry?
Yeah, definitely no rockets in East London.
East London? Yeah. I thought you were Kingston.
No, from East London. So I would say I never actually had much exposure to the space industry growing up. Apart from an uncle who was studying aerospace engineering when I was about 4 years old. We were being looked after by him a lot. So my parents were going for a divorce. So my uncle had the burden of taking care of my sister and I. So in order to study and keep us entertained, he would say, oh, look at this, and show us little planets and telescopes and so on. And I remember thinking and saying apparently to my mom, I will go to NASA and I will work there. At the age of 4, which no one from my area has ever done before. At school, I just loved physics, kept going down that route. Also, I would say thought I'd be a lawyer, historian, you know, that whole kind of different angle of life. At
not
that
a doctor
point.
As well?
No.
Never a doctor?
Blood really freaks me out. I wish, but no, I can't handle the blood. Finally got my results and thought, okay, I'm going to do a theoretical physics degree at university and let's see where this goes. Did that and actually found out that I'm good at and really enjoy physics of galaxies and stars and space-time and gravity. So really kind of learning the whole Star Trek, Star Wars vibe. Then ended up getting a scholarship to do my master's at the International Space University.
Okay.
So I was funded by ESA and the UK Space Agency.
ESA, European Space Agency.
Yeah. Used that to kind of head over to Strasbourg, first time out of East London, and then met a professor there who apparently had done his PhD at NASA Goddard. And he said to me, my old supervisor is looking for someone to lead a astrophysics project. Would you be interested? Of course, I wasn't going to say no. I went there, went to NASA, absolutely.
And that was
loved
in
it.
Florida or Houston or where was
close to Washington, D.C., so okay. In Greenbelt, Maryland. So it was the astrobiology unit, building 34. So if anyone is aware of the James Webb telescope, that was being built in the clean room there. In my youth, I got to go and see that and I was like, wow.
So the James Webb telescope, that's one of the most advanced telescopes.
Exactly.
Because you get amazing pictures
of
deep space. Yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, really right up my street, literally and figuratively. And so I thought, wow, I have to do space for the rest of my life. So then went to the European Space Agency and actually worked on moon-related projects. So mine was radiation shielding simulations of lunar regolith to see how we can build a habitat that can actually sustain life. So there was that. Met my husband there, who's also a space nerd, as I like to call it. Then went over to SES, worked in engineering.
Okay, so it was SES that brought you to Luxembourg then?
Yes, exactly. Went into the engineering department of SES 17. So learned kind of the whole value chain and the program management of it, which opened my eyes up to more of that commercial space. Mm. So did that, went into strategy and finance, and then eventually thought, well, how can I combine my passion of sustainability, the technical background, and actually just kind of whole domain of engineering and space strategy and so on into one. Basically developed the ESG sustainability department. So got to work on kind of everything from space junk to launch impacts on the environment.
So now you're running a consultancy, an advisory service, similar to what Jordan was doing
yeah.
when he started off
yes.
in Taiwan, right?
Yeah.
So, and then Jordan, so you saw a niche and then went off and started your own company. Do you think you'll be doing the same thing, Sabrina?
The reason why I'm doing what I'm doing now is because I then ran the EU space practice at KPMG. And with that, saw a lot of potential within the European space domain. I think one of the great things about Europe is there's great people, a lot of ambition, but there's a need to strategize a little bit more and come together and look at procurement procedures and see how we actually operate throughout that value chain. So I thought, why not open my own company and an own firm and continue doing that?
So Jordan, you said you've been here for 7 years with Odysseus Space.
Yeah, maybe just one word also about how we actually arrived in Luxembourg. We joined a competition at the time called the Space Research Challenge. And that to that competition that we pitched the idea of laser communication. And we actually won the competition. And you know, at first I thought it was just going to be a free flight ticket, maybe some coaching support. But actually, we got real money.
Luxembourg government run?
Yes, it was the Ministry of Economy, a program called Luximpulse at the time. But this is how we arrived. We won a competition. Wow. And you know, it was just before COVID. That was tough.
Yes.
But the good side of that is that Luxembourg has been really building a strong space ecosystem. We see now dozens and dozens and dozens of space companies. I see already the tremendous, you know, growth of space ecosystem.
So before we get on to the wider thing, let's just focus on Odysseus a little bit. So how big is the company now? What do you have operating? Are your lasers already in space shooting communications around?
So we have, right now we have exactly 33 people. Everyone is here based in Luxembourg. We actually are delivering our first flight model, space laser terminal to go on board the satellite this spring. And we are going to also deploy our optical ground station to receive the data from space in summer. So we are going to launch in February our first space terminal.
So exciting times then.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing the announcements of successful launch and successful communication.
Me too. Yeah.
So 7 years, 33 people. Yeah. Those people, do you find them in Luxembourg or do you attract people to move here?
You know, it's always a bit of a tricky question here because it's very difficult to find people, I think, in general. And also here in Luxembourg, you know, you face a situation where young people don't really think about Luxembourg. And they don't necessarily, you know, see it attractive. And people who are more senior, they already have their families. Yeah. It's a bit more difficult to make them move from their place.
The space hubs in Europe then, where are competitions? Where are the other people that are involved in space?
Well, I'm biased. I'd say the UK. Okay.
UK is in Europe.
Okay, let me hang
geographically,
on to yeah, geographically, but let me hang on to pre-Brexit days too. So the UK has a massive space hub, particularly in Oxford. And then I'd say the Netherlands do a good job. France and Germany, from my perspective, have a lot going on in the space industry, from manufacturing to whether it be consulting and exploration. But one of the things I'd say is that they are very legacy type companies that are based there, quite integrated within the governmental network and so on. And where I find Luxembourg has that unique place is really on the innovation aspect.
Luxembourg is a very strong, you know, Europe believer and really playing the game of Europe. I think the challenge, you know, in the next few years will be that countries in Europe don't try to just get things for themselves, right? It's like we are facing a situation now where you will be, for example, you know, competing against, I don't know, let's say companies in France or Germany, you know, doing similar things. And then, of course, you know, the country will prefer to take their own company. The reality is there is still a national preference that we see.
But do we avoid some of the deep-rooted national preferences? So if you're France, you probably really don't want something to go to England, where you kind of don't mind it going to Luxembourg. Do we play in the gaps a little bit?
I believe Luxembourg is a great place for not just for the European ecosystem, but for the global ecosystem. And what I mean by that is that Europe is advancing in terms of, you know, actual commission funding and defense funding. So what it's doing is almost being the European hub for US companies to come over to Europe, or UK companies to come over to Europe and setting up shop here and saying, okay, we're creating our European headquarters in Luxembourg because we have the support of the government. And Luxembourg plays a brilliant role in that aspect.
Yeah, it's true that, you know, if you are coming from a non-European country, if you have to pick a country in Europe, I think Luxembourg is exactly. The best place. It's way smoother, you know, to move as a foreigner here.
So I just want to bring it down from you CEOs talking about the politics and the big picture to some of the specifics. So Javier, as an engineer, you explained you did this project on the moon of picking up dust. Like, so is that it's like the world's most expensive dustpan you've created. What's hard about creating a dustpan in space?
Well, I think some of the challenges I would say are technical and some are cultural. So in terms of technical challenges, dealing with designing hardware for space, is a unique environment there, the vacuum environment, the radiative environment of space. So we have to be really careful about what we send there.
And what stops things functioning in a vacuum? You think it'd be easier in a vacuum because there's nothing there. So
it's a good question. I think that, well, materials off gas in particular, they don't operate the same way they would operate in an Earth environment. Say soft materials like plastics, or many plastics can be difficult to use in the space environment.
And then the radiation affects the plastics and makes them degrade quicker than they would do on Earth. Is that what happens?
That can happen. And also radiation affects electronics quite a bit. I'm not an expert in electronics, but I'm aware that's one of the concerns.
So solar radiation are affecting any electronics, I think, for anyone, you know, flying anything in space. So that's also something we pay attention to. You have to test, you know, under radiation, your system. We also pay attention to atomic oxygen, because in our case, you know, that can deteriorate the optical system of the terminal. You have to do also thermal vacuum cycling that we actually run at Luna Outpost sometimes. You have to do vibration testing. There is a lot of tests you have to do before flying anything in space, yes.
Yeah, another concern is the thermal extremes of the space environment, where if you're going from minus 180 to plus 200 on the lunar surface, maybe.
Degrees centigrade.
Yes. Yeah. Then maybe... then those materials are going to expand and contract, and they expand and contract in different ways. You need to reconcile that in your design.
Interesting stuff. So we found a bit about your journeys into the space industry and some of the challenges of dealing with space and the benefits of Luxembourg. Let's take a break, and then when we come back, we'll get into some of the trivia questions. We came all this way to explore the moon, and the most important thing is that we discovered the Earth. This quote from NASA astronaut William Allison Anders prompts us to answer the questions. Is the most important thing in space Earth? Should we devote our time and efforts to protecting Earth? In other words, what should be the limit of our business in space? And whilst all my guests are involved in the space industry, as we've discovered, the focus is different. Jordan is looking to improve communications on Earth, whilst Javier is looking further to help inhabit the moon. What should be our ambitions in space?
Space plays a vital role in every part of our lives, from telecommunications to Earth observation, disaster response management, to education, healthcare, and I could go on and on. But from my point of view, we need to expand on that. What can space do for society? And by that, I mean, we have real challenges on Earth right now, from climate change, from defense, so on.
But throwing a load of rockets up emitting CO2, isn't that actually a bad thing to do for sustainability and climate change?
Well, look, I think you can see it in different ways, and part of the work I've done is also see how we can limit that impact, because at the end of the day, space needs to happen. And by that, I mean, you're not going to get the right data models to understand, well, what do we need on Earth without using space tech. But we can do it in a way that it's also limiting our impact on the Earth environment, but also providing significant benefit to the Earth environment. It's not just beneficial for sustainability, but also economic sustainability as well. And by that, we look at the financial industry, insurance industry, that all need space data in order to have good data models going forward.
Okay. So that's looking somewhat using space to look down on Earth and support Earth. But Javier, you're trying to build, if I understand correctly, a outpost so humans can stay on the moon forever, right?
Yeah, ideally, yes.
Is it going to be a holiday vacation for me? What should we have up on the moon?
I hope it gets to the point where we can have recreation there. But I'd say at first, there are a lot of economic drivers. And there's also, I think, an intrinsic desire to explore. I think that if we zoom out a little bit and ask ourselves, like, 500 years from now, when we look back to this moment, what will we say about humanity? What I think that a lot of people will define this moment as a time where humans were focused on AI and space, where those two technologies really change the trajectory of our advance. And part of our advance is physical movement. It's going out and living in different places, exploring and gathering resources as well.
How many years until we establish a outpost on the moon?
Within the next 10 years.
Next 10 years?
Yeah.
Do you think you'll go?
I would 100% sign up. Yeah.
You might sign up, but do you think you'll get there?
I've applied to be an astronaut a few times. I'd love to go. I'd love to go. Yeah.
So just to bounce also on what Sabrina was saying, indeed we produce more and more and more and more data in space, and these data are very valuable for Earth as well. This is one of the things we are doing at Odysseus Space. It's to help humankind actually to gather all this data, but to transmit them back to Earth. And let me be also a bit of a dreamer here. I believe also on the moon exploration, Mars exploration, and further. And that's why also I think we need communication. You want still to be able to communicate, whether we are talking about scientific data or just humans, you know, living on the moon or Mars. You want to be able to communicate to the ground, right? And I believe what we are doing can help humankind to go further in space and to see that we have bigger things to do and, you know, just fighting each other on Earth.
Yeah. Well, and not sure if everyone's aware, but space is predicted to have a value of over $1 trillion by 2035. That's quite close by. And the current rate we're going is one that won't essentially reach that value because we haven't tapped into that commercial viability yet. And by that, I mean, how are we actually going to bridge space and other domains and other industries and provide true value on a constant basis?
So that would generate $1 trillion of economic value. And I was reading into it. We currently spend about a tenth on space of what it would cost to address climate change.
Yeah.
So maybe if we grow the space industry, we can use that economic benefit then to then support the improvements for climate change. Would that be the...
Well, for sure. And I think people underestimate the role space plays in climate change.
From a positive perspective.
On the positive perspective. And that's really where I like to show off space. Space does everything from actually predicting, well, what are going to be the most impacted regions? How can you actually mitigate the amount of methane production? All these kind of things, wildlife poaching, and so much more. The technical possibilities are endless. And now it's about how do we invest in the right mechanisms to actually bring this down and make it applicable going forward and solve real challenges. And that's where the value in this $1 trillion is going to come from.
A lot of people think, oh, why do we spend all this money on a space mission? But actually, they forget that we don't take this money and send the money to space, you know. this money actually stays on Earth, right? And it's you have companies living, you have people creating values. And also, it's not just burning money. And also, then it allows us to get all this data and to support Earth.
Right now, we're not perfect in the industry. There's a lot of work we have to do to be better and to reduce our environmental footprint as well. And let's not shy away from that. And that's also worth investment. But ESA, LSA, there's some really good examples out there of good work that's being done to help address some of the concerns on the I would say, sustainability impact on Earth from the space industry?
I think that a lot of times we see a narrative of that is adversarial between like space technology and environmental protection. And I really just don't see that in my daily life. I think that a lot of people who are passionate about space are also quite passionate. A lot of young people in particular are quite passionate about environmental concerns too. And they can complement each other.
One of the things when I studied physics that really came out, Thomas Pesquet, French astronaut, also said a similar thing. When you learn space, when you understand space, space is so vast, it's endless. There's one habitable planet that we know of, and that's Earth. So the thought that we're destroying the only thing that can sustain us as humans or sustain life is incredible. And actually, that's why this kind of sustainability passion is there, and why I think so many space enthusiasts love saving the planet too.
Yeah, I think a lot of people misunderstand that. I was background in the oil industry, and everything you work for the oil industry must not care about the environment. It's like, no, absolute opposite. I worked in the oil industry so I could do it in an ethical way. There was the right way to do it because people use the energy, how to do it right. So I agree with you that it's not always adversarial, and we have a lot more in common than we are when we're different. Two quick fire questions before we move to a close. One is space junk. Is that a problem that's going to destroy all the satellites? How big a problem is that?
It's a problem. It really is a problem. And reason being is that what we've done on Earth, we've kind of done in space. Space is limited, despite what I said before, but the orbit around our Earth is limited. And so we need to think smarter. We can't just throw things up there and say, oh, let's see how it goes. Or say we're decommissioning, or we're just going to burn it up in the atmosphere.
Do we have a solution to this problem?
There are loads of companies actually that are making ways within this domain. So from extending the life of satellites to refueling, to bringing them back to Earth and to recycling, and it's moving.
Indeed, there are companies who, want to clean up the space, but who is going to pay for
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Right?
And that brings me to the next thing, that no one owns space at the moment. Space obviously gets put with defense. How much of a problem do you see space as the final frontier, but maybe the final front line on competition and war?
Personally, there are many agreements in place that enforce a peaceful use of outer space, and I think that those will last in the short term. And perhaps not in the long term. I think it's pretty much inevitable that as a domain where humans exist, that there will be conflict in space, just like any other domain.
And short term in your...
Well, I mean, space currently gets used for defense in many ways, but there is not direct combat in space at this moment, I would say within the next 30 years.
Space is the first line of defense. And so when we think about economic impact, it's very likely to be the first thing that will be looked at from the defense capability perspective. You wipe out telecommunications, quite easy to do. You wipe out imagery. You basically lose all of your kind of ground defense or foundations of defense.
It's kind of economic. Okay, I'm at risk of opening up a whole another episode, so we'll move on from that. So let's just talk very briefly on the future then. So I think we touched on the future for Odysseus Space, have your launch coming up in the spring and the summer, connecting to the ground. Yeah, then after that, what's the next plan?
Yeah, so we are deploying a network of optical ground station. The idea is to give opportunities to our customers to download their data from the laser terminal. So,
and your customers are who then?
So our customers, imagine like any satellite who want to get a lot of data from their satellite to the ground.
And then what are you working on at the moment? Is it another space dustpan, or what's the...
Yeah, good question. The future, I'd say, is in lunar night survival technology. So, we spend millions, tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars to send things to the moon, and they last the 2 weeks of lunar day on the moon, but die over the 2 weeks of lunar night due to temperatures and lack of power. Our company has a big project funded by the Luxembourg Space Agency to advance thermal technologies for lunar night survival technology. I believe that that's where many companies will be focused, so that they can have that investment last a longer term.
Exciting stuff. And for yourself, Sabrina?
The role at the university is really bringing the research to life and into industry, into government, everything from quantum tech to space exploration research and so on, Earth observation. So looking forward to being that glue almost between industry, research, and matter, space and defense is really looking to bring that resilience aspect to both the space and defense industry. So how can we do space and defense in a way that's really for the benefit of mankind, or humankind rather?
That's brilliant. So there's a lot going on. It feels like a bit of a diverse community of people within the space industry. So is that the right assessment? Is it full of MIT, Stanford educated people, or is there a mix?
There's definitely a mix. And I think Luxembourg does a brilliant job at bringing people from all backgrounds, shapes, sizes, everything to one place and saying, you can do good work here and let's advance the industry together.
So it's a place that even a girl from the east of London in Stratford can feel at home in the space industry.
Yes, exactly. And so space is made for really everyone. And that's what I love to promote as well. So interested, then get in touch.
And how would they do that? So how would they get in contact with yourself?
LinkedIn, definitely the way.
Okay, Jordan?
Yeah, LinkedIn as well. Just want to say as well, you know, Luxembourg brings people from all over the place. I can see in my company, we are 33 people right now. We have more than 15 nationalities.
In our company, 16 people and 14 different nationalities to the best, last time I checked. So really unique compared to anywhere else I've ever worked. And I love that. And for me, LinkedIn works best. Thank you. And Lunar Outpost website, lunaroutpost.com.
Yeah, and I hear there's a place where people go as well. Space beer,
that's correct. You'll find many of us last Thursday of every month from the space community in Luxembourg having informal conversations at Independent Cafe on the final Thursday.
So that's the one by the FDR bus stop.
7 p.m. and yes.
Brilliant. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Adam.